From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today's program is made possible by the support of electricity. Somewhere deep underground, men and machines are scratching coal out of the earth. It's being driven to a power plant where it's burned to generate electricity, which is then transmitted across wires to our equipment and to your radios, computers, and smartphones. That system experienced a huge disruption on June 29th when a derecho storm swept across central Illinois, delivering hurricane-force winds and leaving as many as 500,000 people here and in Indiana without power. Personally, my family went 6 days and 6 hours without electricity. And side note, a week of allergy attacks from open windows is why my voice today has all the charm of a diesel generator. Fortunately, the power disruptions are mostly resolved. Just before we went to air Monday morning, Springfield's City Water, Light and Power reported 40 customers without electricity, and Ameren likewise said just 83 of its Illinois customers are without service, and that's out of a combined nearly 1.3 million. Given that, we thought the time was right to take a step back and look at some of the factors that made this massive disruption possible. And one of the biggest problems is the state of the grid. The poles and wires on which almost all of our electricity travels. Joining me now to talk more about this is Gretchen Bakke. She's an anthropologist with a PhD from the University of Chicago, and today is a Heisenberg Research Fellow at Humboldt University in Berlin. But more to the point for our conversation, she's the author of the 2016 book, The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. She's often asked to share her research and perspective after major power disruptions, and I'm grateful she made time to be with us today. Gretchen Bakke, welcome to The 21st Show.
Thank you very much.
As ever, if you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. Did you see the weakness of our electrical grid firsthand after the storms a week and a half ago? Or do you have a question about the grid? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. That's 800-222-9455. All right, so Gretchen Bakke, you've written that the most common day-to-day threat to our power system comes not from terrorists or hackers or the weather, but from trees. So I thought maybe you could begin by just telling us what happens when a single tree limb snaps a power line.
It depends on how much stress there is on the system as a whole. If there's one tree limb that hits one power line, often there's a backup power line that's in place. And we've done that over the last 30 or 40 years. We've been putting in these sort of parallel lines. But when you have a big wind and it takes down several power lines, or if you have a lot of heat and the power lines stretch out, which is just something that metal does when it gets hot, and they sort of bend down into the trees and make contact with them and then short out, then you can get a cascading failure, which is to say the electricity sort of doesn't have anywhere to go. It might be on one line moving where it needs to go, and it can move to another line and continue to move where it needs to go. But after three or four lines are down, that's when you start to get these blackouts, in part because as the electricity is trying to figure out where to go, it will overload other lines. So it's not just the lines that have gone down. It's the fact that the cascading part of it is that you get all this electricity sort of sloshing around on the system and taking down perfectly reasonable power lines that were in good working order, but are not anymore.
Well, and that's what's so interesting about the electrical grid, and you write about this in your book. We use these metaphors like water, electricity flows like water. It's a series of tubes, people might say, but it's actually very different. And the electrical grid cannot just stop the way a set of water pipes can, right?
Yeah, I know. And I just thought of that when I used the word sloshing, because it gives you a feeling for what's happening, but it's not at all accurate. So water follows a certain set of physical rules. It always goes downhill, for example. It will join into larger pools of water and just make a bigger river and continue on its way. But electricity doesn't have any physical presence. It's a force, the way that gravity is a force. And so when we try to think about an electric grid, we have this image. In fact, we used to call them electric mains, the wires. We have this image of these wires with electricity inside of them, and it's flowing along, and that it somehow acts like a material thing in the world. But actually, it is always acting in a way that is a little bit impossible for us to understand as regular people. And so we build these systems for it. The physics of those systems are really good. They make sense with the way that electricity works, but all the rest of us are sort of grappling in our minds to understand what's happening at any given time or how to correct for a set of problems. And especially because a lot of the work, sort of the money that goes into the grid is done by, and the way tariffs are set, the way the price is set is done by the state legislature. And this is not electrical engineers. So the utility has all these experts on it. And then there's this other force, there's us, we use electricity, but there's this other force, which is the people who make the laws and give the sort of grant money for upgrades and stuff like that. And they don't understand electricity either. So it's a lot of people intervening in this system that none of us are very good at getting, except these very specifically trained electrical engineers. And I can talk a little bit about the structure of like why electricity moves the way that it does through a grid.
Let's think about that in the context then, because we talked about what happens when a tree limb leans on a power line or snaps a power line. But when you have a massive storm system, which delivers hurricane force winds across an entire region and snaps many tree limbs and full trunks onto power lines. And I saw power poles that were snapped like they were toothpicks without even any trees nearby. What do those circumstances do to an electrical grid, right? Demand goes to zero. The stations are still burning coal and gas. What happens?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we don't quite grasp about electricity is that it's this just-in-time delivery system. So if a coal-burning plant is making electricity, that is coming to you, that coal is being combusted, and it's coming into your light in your house or your hot water heater in your house or your stove in your house within about a minute. So if the lines go down, we can't turn the coal burning plant off that fast. And so there's still electricity pumping into the system, even though we can't use it. And electricity can't really be stored. So we talk about storage a lot, we think about storage a lot, but because it's not a thing, it's not like, again, not like water, you can't just pour it into a glass and use it later. You can pour it into a tiny little battery, but that battery isn't even holding electricity inside of it. It's holding a set of chemical relationships that allow a battery to make electricity later. So we have the system, which is very fast. It's just in time. And on the generation side, so the place where we create electricity, if we're using fossil fuels, they're very, very difficult to turn up and turn down quickly. So you start to take down lines. So you're taking down all of the use, what we call load. You're taking all the use off the grid, but you still have all this electricity pumping into the grid. And that's very bad for it. We could just put it that way simply. But also storms in general, big storms do have a tendency to uproot trees and throw them all over the place. And since in the US, our wire system is above ground, where in some places that makes a lot of sense that it's above ground and other places less, it just means it's particularly vulnerable to big storm systems or to very, very strong winds, and also often to heavy rain. So substations are at ground level. They're usually not inside. So if there's heavy rain, we can also flood those out. And that's where the electricity, which is quite high voltage coming out of the power plant, gets switched down to a lower voltage that we use domestically and in our buildings at a substation. So if you take out a substation, it's another way of just making a break in the grid. And it's very, very, very hard to protect a large electricity system like the one we have in the US, like we have in many, many places in the world, from extreme weather.
Well, and as we experience, the consequence of that is that many of us go a week or more without power when you do have this major disruption. So let me just remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Gretchen Bakke, who is the author of the book, The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. It came out back in 2016. So your book looks closely at two storms, the Great Coastal Gale in the Pacific Northwest, which I have to admit I don't remember hearing about at the time in 2008. Then again, I don't know if people in the Pacific Northwest heard about the great derecho of 2023 here in the Midwest either. But and then there was Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast in 2012. So what did we learn about our electrical systems from those two events?
Well, they were both really devastating, and I think the derecho is gives a real feeling for how local a tragedy can be. I mean, there really are some that we hear a lot about, Katrina, or just because it was so extreme, it's had such extreme effects, and also, of course, the blackout in New York City or across the whole East Coast. But locally, these local storms, which are so devastating, they often don't make the news. And as utilities are scrambling to put everything back together again, there is a sense of the world not noticing that, and it is still a real tragedy. And the grappling, at least, so I'm originally from Oregon, and that's where I am right now, in coastal Oregon, and the ramifications of that particular storm, we're now years away from it, is a lot of people started to think about how they could protect not necessarily their electricity systems, because that seems sort of out of our hands in a way, but their heat, their capacity to make heat, and sort of to keep warm and to make some sort of light at home. And so a lot of smaller scale kind of do-it-yourself systems sprang up, and a lot of community, like just community contact between people to help each other out. In times of stress. We saw this to some degree in Texas too, during the Great Freeze, that communities started to figure out networks of ways where places where people could charge their phones and get clean water, these sorts of things. But the rise of a kind of independent energy, maybe just heat, we really saw that in the aftermath of the Great Coastal Gale.
Yeah, no, I was definitely
here. Thankful. I mean, you guys are very close to your storm, so I'm not sure what the long-term outcome of that will be. But sure. any power outage more than about 3 days causes individuals to begin to think about how they can be a different kind of collective.
Yeah, no, I definitely was at the very least eyeing my neighbors who had generators, or rather hearing them as I was sweating at night through the night. And thankful it wasn't winter, I will say that, because we most of, even if you have gas heat here, you still require electricity to activate the blower. It doesn't do you that much good. But, you know, I'm also watching our city scrambling to restore the electrical grid, right? All hands on deck, called in scores of crews and trucks from other states, and they put things back just the way they were, right? I'm grateful for that. On the other hand, I just wonder if we're the second little pig, right? Rebuilding our house made out of sticks.
Yeah, I mean, this is always the problem, which is that if we have to repair the electricity system in a moment of panic, which is usually when we are working on it, the easiest thing to do is just get it up and running again. And then, of course, everyone kind of forgets about it. Give it another week, another 2 weeks, another 3 weeks, and suddenly it's going to be like, oh, there's that electricity system. We turn our lights, they go on, that's that. And everybody sort of goes along as they always were. But the vulnerabilities to that system are the same if we don't make changes every time it goes down. And I understand that in this week of panic, you know, and it's just to get power back to everybody, that's not the first thing in the utility's mind. But hopefully behind the scenes, there will be a lot of talk about how to not have this substantial of an outage again. What can be done in order to make the system more resilient, or just sort of, so more resilient just means it comes back faster, right? You're not out for 6 days, you're out for 6 hours, or just more stable, which is to say it doesn't go down at all. And those are two different sets of demands on the electricity system. But, you know, 2 days of power outages, people kind of almost enjoy themselves. There's this sort of playfulness to it. Everybody, you know, eats all their food, people get together.
We're camping, yeah.
Yeah, but then after that, it's not fun anymore. It's just not fun anymore. So my hope for you would be that there's a lot of things happening, a lot of discussions happening behind the scenes about how this kind of storm, tornadoes, you can't do anything about it, really. But a big thunderstorm There should be some sort of, or extreme flooding, there should be some sort of way that the grid can be strengthened, or its shape can be shifted a little bit. And you gestured toward that by saying that people have diesel generators. That's a way of having a kind of parallel to the grid that's in place that helps people when the big system is down, helps create what people need from electricity. I saw this quote from, I believe it was the mayor, who said that something like everybody is out, like your fridge is down, your air conditioning is down, your dishwasher is down, your washing machine is down. And that these are things that we don't care about electricity, right? We care about what electricity, how electricity makes our lives livable and good. And that can maybe be done in a parallel way. So that's one thing that people also begin to think about is what is a system that can be there for people when the big grid goes down, because the weather will take down the electric grid. And we see that every week. If you look at America's news right now, there's a power outage somewhere.
Somewhere every week. Absolutely.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll continue with Gretchen Bakke when we return. She's the author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. We're talking about some of the longer term implications of the derecho storms that swept across central Illinois a week and a half ago. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with Gretchen Bakke, who is a Heisenberg Research Fellow at Humboldt University in Berlin. She is a PhD anthropologist from the University of Chicago, and she's the author of the book, The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. This book first came out in 2016. It was one of those Bill Gates picks. If you're not familiar with it, he does book picks, kind of like Oprah does. And it was well-reviewed at the time. She's often asked to share her perspective and research after major power discussions. And that's why I'm glad she made the time to be with us today. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. So, Gretchen Bakke, maybe we can talk about some of the bigger picture issues with the electrical grid, especially, I think, this storm, right? We can't pin any one particular weather event on climate change, but it certainly seems like the ingredients or the conditions are there for more severe weather. And so because of that, Illinois is among the states that has really made a commitment to eliminate coal-fired power plants heading into the future, natural gas plants as well, and move to renewable solar, wind energy, as well as nuclear power. I think it's interesting. I was not really familiar before reading your work about some of the problems with wind and solar. You often hear the talking point, well, what do you do when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow? But it actually can be a big problem when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing for our electrical grid, the way it's set up. Can you talk about some of the issues that this transition to renewable energy is bringing to our old grid system?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the best examples is when you have a big storm. So you let's say that you're not making power from coal anymore, and you're making it mostly from wind and some from solar. And then there's a big storm. And what happens in a big storm, those wind turbines, they move really fast and they produce a lot of electricity. And that is great, but it has to have somewhere to go. And so this is the problem, of course, is that up at a certain point, the amount of power that's being made on a very windy day is not necessarily predictable. We have some idea now, more than when I wrote the book, about what will be happening with the wind in the next couple of days. So we can see a little bit what's happening. But nevertheless, too much power on the electrical system is just as bad for it as too little power. And that's because of what I was saying before, where how much electricity we use has to be really perfectly matched to how much we produce. It's a lot easier with a natural gas power plant to just sort of turn it up a little bit at 4 p.m. when you know everyone's going to go home and they're all going to go walk in. They're going to turn up their air conditioning. They're going to open their fridge 27 times before they make dinner. The lights are going to start to go on. The TV's going to go on. And this is a kind of predictable set of demands on the grid. And you can adjust for that with fossil fuels. To a certain degree with nuclear as well, certainly with hydropower. But with wind power, if it's not that windy right then, or if you have a lot of solar power and the sun is starting to set, it introduces a new set of difficulties to what we call balancing the grid.
And there's sometimes so much supply. I think, at least at the time of your book, Hawaii, just the rooftop solar that people had installed in Hawaii was sometimes more power than the state needed. But it's not like they can just, as you said earlier, you can't just switch off a coal or natural gas fire power plant and turn it back on 2 hours later.
Right, exactly. And we have this everywhere now where there's a lot of solar. You end up with a ton of electricity being made in the middle of the day. But that's not when we use the most electricity. And with wind too, we see this in Texas. It's a big problem that the wind blows very, very strongly in the middle of the night. And again, it's not the time that we're using the most electricity. So the question is, what do you do with it? Do you just sort of let it go? Do you turn off those wind turbines? Do you pay people even? That's what they do in Texas sometimes, is they pay people to use electricity in the middle of the night, which is to say, you would say to any big manufacturer, like, okay, you make plastic cups. From now on, you're going to make plastic cups from 11 p.m. until 4 a.m. if that's when the wind is blowing. So there's a kind of response that we can make on the user side to absorb some of that electricity. But the big lesson really is that we have to think differently about our relationship to electricity, because we can't just use it whenever we want. That's not true. We can use it whenever we want, but if we can learn to be responsive to the amount of electricity being made, it's a lot easier to have a lot more renewables on the system.
Yeah, I heard an interview where you talked about a community where basically at 9 p.m. everyone goes and switches on their dishwasher at that time because power is cheaper or free at night, basically. Yeah.
The British at one point brought down their electrical grid because they use electric kettles in England, and there was some giant soccer match and it had a pause, like a timeout, and everybody got up and turned on their electric kettle and they crashed the grid for the whole area because nobody had predicted that there would be that kind of draw on the grid at that moment. So there's big problems on the grid, like the derecho. There's little problems like everybody turning on the dishwasher at the same time. And those are all headaches. They all decrease the stability of the electricity system.
We've had a couple of callers with asking the same sort of question. Let's go to line four now. Sam is calling in from Springfield. Sam, thanks for calling in.
Oh, my pleasure. A couple of quick questions. One, would it do any good with the storm damage to bury the lines underground? And two, how vulnerable is our grid to electromagnetic attacks from terrorists or foreign powers?
All right, Sam, thanks for those questions. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
So burying the lines in a place that has a low water table. So if you're not living in a swamp, not Florida, not where I live here in Western Oregon, but if you're living in a place where it's reasonably dry underground, burying the lines is a very good idea. It makes the grid much, much more stable. It's also insanely expensive. And this is why we see most utilities not choosing to make this decision. Though now that the power goes out more and more often from storm damage, if it starts to be a couple times a year, three times a year, four times a year, five times a year that they're replacing lines or fixing lines, then the economic decisions begin to sort of point toward underground more than they had previously, basically. There's an economic logic to it. But for sure, for stability, underground lines is great if you don't live on a swamp. That's the short answer.
And he also asked EMT, about terrorism. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, for the EMT, this is what we call a low probability, high impact event. So it's much more likely that your power will go down because there's a squirrel has been chewing through lines or critical pieces of infrastructure, or that a tree grows up and shorts out a line. That's much more likely. It has usually a smaller impact. However, if there were an EMT pulse, that would indeed take out a big piece of the grid, not permanently. It would be a lot like your derecho; it would be down for a while. But it's much, it's such a low probability given how many other problems we have, that there is a whole bureau in the federal government who looks at these things, also at cyber attacks, also at physical attacks. There have been quite a few physical attacks on substations in recent years where people just go and shoot them with shotguns. So there's all kinds of risks to the grid, and that is one of them. But it's not probably the one that's going to cause you the most trouble in your actual life in the next few years. We hope
Watch out for the tree limbs. So we're coming to the end of our time together. You have made the point that a lot of people are looking to electrification as a better future for our warming planet. But if my family had purchased that induction stove we've been looking at, or maybe we had an electric car instead of a hybrid car, this power outage would have been that much more disruptive to our lives. Can we electrify our way out of climate change?
So we can electrify our way out of climate change, but that doesn't mean that just electrifying everything and thinking that we're fine is some sort of answer, because climate change, even if we stop using fossil fuels today, which we're not doing, we're going to have the weather we have today indefinitely. So if you're having more big windstorms now and everything stops right now, those big windstorms will continue. And we aren't stopping everything right now, in part because it's a really difficult project to do that globally, right? It's not just Illinois. It has to be done on a global scale. So the issue is that we need to figure out a way to have viable backup systems, which aren't diesel generators. That's what our go-to right now, that allow for people to have some home or building level or community level or neighborhood level backup or secondary system to what the big power grid is. And there are a lot of people working on this, like what can you do with a home solar system? How can you change the law and the way the grid is made so that a home solar system will be allowed to be on when the power is down on the big grid? Because in most places that is not currently allowed. That means if you have solar panels and the power goes down around you, you have to turn those solar panels off. You cannot use that electricity yourself, but you can use a diesel generator. And this is obviously against the logic of the current system. If we're going to electrify everything, then we need to figure out a way for small systems to be able to remain on, especially small renewably powered systems, to remain on when the big grid is down, because it will continue to go down. And right now we back that up with fossil fuels.
Gretchen Bakke is the author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. Thank you so much for making the time to be with us today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. And I hope that you all recover well from this big storm.
Thank you very much.